Hey, what's going on? It's Dr. Mike T. Nelson here. Welcome back to the Flex Diet Podcast. And on this podcast, we talk about all things to increase strength and hypertrophy, performance, improve your body composition, and do it all without destroying your health in a flexible framework. Today on the program, I've got a very crazy interview with my buddy, Justin Kavanaugh. If you're in the coaching circles for, I would say, advanced athletes, especially track athletes, professional athletes, Olympic athletes, I guarantee you've heard of him. If not, you may not have heard of him. He works with all sorts of high-end athletes. He's worked with some of the fastest humans around. One of the main ones there is going to be Justin Gatlin. So worked with Tokyo Olympic Jason Rogers. Tens of thousands of high-level athletes from NFL, NHL, Olympics, you name it. And he has an extremely wide background from everything from advanced recovery, which we're going to talk about today, strength training, periodization, you name it. He's done or experienced it. And the reason I wanted to have him on the podcast today is to go down the deep rabbit hole on recovery and what are some of the methods that he uses with his athletes. And of course, the basics are going to work, as I cover in the Flex Diet certification. There's no denying that. But when you're working with elite level humans at the top level, you're going to do the basics and you're going to do everything else. And that may be a kitchen sink type approach. And one of the words of advice I got from a buddy, from Frankie, years ago was look for weird people that get results, which I always thought that was super interesting. And in a nice way, I would put Cav in that category. And the one thing you know about working with high-level athletes, especially in events like track and field, and pretty much all high-level athletics now, is they're going to test things and they're going to know if you are full of shit or if what you're doing is working or not. So as weird and wacky as some of the stuff sounds, I always keep that in mind that if it was not working, there's no way they would have him back to try to do stuff again. So we talk here about everything from the use of some peptides. You can see the podcast I did with Dr. Ryan Green, my buddy Dr. Andy Galpin. We'll link to that. Some of the neurostim, I guess you could put devices in there, such as the Dolphin and others. And Cav was very open about all the different recovery metrics and different things that he uses with high-level athletes. Some of them are quite expensive and rare or hard to find. I will try to put as many links in the notes as I can, but some of them, they're just not around. And some of the other ones are pretty easy to find and not super expensive either. So I've taken a couple of the tips that he's given me, and I did it on my right knee in South Padre. I came down a little bit hot off jump kiteboarding. Wasn't damaged or anything like that, just overloaded the muscle, and it was pretty darn sore for a couple days. And yeah, literally 48 hours later, I was out riding and it felt pretty good. So who knows? N of one, but check out all this great information from him. And then if you want more information about the certifications that he's done, you can go to StrongerExperts.com. Shout out to our buddy Phil there. And if you are a speed coach, I would highly recommend The Art and Science of Speed Training with Coach Cav and Hank Krajanoff. Hank's another guy that if you are around this area in depth, I'm sure you've heard of him. If not, he's probably one of the winningest Olympic coaches around. He's based out of the Netherlands. So check out their program. I'll put a link to it. I also have a nutrition program that I've done for Stronger Experts. And then also the Flex Diet certification will open again on June 5th. Of this year, 2023. It'll be open for 1 week until June 12th. So if you want the basic and even go into some intermediate and some advanced stuff of a foundational system to use for nutrition and recovery. Obviously, I'm super biased because I've put, oh man, I added it up the other day. I was saying 13 years, and it's actually been 16 years now that I've been looking at the concepts of metabolic flexibility, and even longer than that working with clients. So you can get the entire system on how I set up nutrition and recovery, everything from the macronutrients like proteins, fats, carbohydrates, how do you know which ones, when to use them, to sleep, micronutrition, different things like NEAT, non-exercise activity, thermogenesis, walking, moving, twitching, etc. All of that is at flexdiet.com. Go there. You can get on the wait list. I'll have some pretty cool bonus items for you, most likely probably just through the newsletter. We'll have a couple other bonus items open to the public. So go to flexdiet.com and enjoy this wide-ranging interview with my buddy Coach Cav. And it goes without saying that this is not medical advice. If you have any medical questions or conditions, please check with your physician. And this is for entertainment purpose only. Enjoy. Welcome back to the Flex Podcast. I'm back here with Coach Cav. How's it going, man?
Oh, fantastic, man. Good seeing you again.
Yeah, it's good to see you. We finally got to meet in person for 2 weekends in a row, actually.
We missed 2 decades of in-person connection. Then we see each other back the week. So it's a win.
Which is pretty wild because I didn't know you were going to be at the Raise the Bar event. And then we talked there. And then you were at the Real Coaches Summit again in Vegas. And you were there helping out the Coach Catalyst guys, correct?
Yeah, they've built an amazing business and really helping coaches. So I've had a lot of, they came in and helped me tremendously with our coaching business. And now being part of the team and seeing how that thing has been able to grow has been fantastic. I think we're really cool when you start looking at like behavior change, which as a coach, we understand that we could force the stuff down of our clients' throats. But at the end of the day, it really comes down to the autonomy of them doing it and working through behavior change, which is where they've been strong. So it's been a lot of help for me. And then I saw the power of it for businesses. So got involved and it's been really fun to see what that could do for the coaching industry.
Yeah. And shout out to Trevor and Kane and everybody there. I met Trevor many years ago and he was kind of the first guy who came up to me and was asking me about the Flex Diet Cert. And so we have exclusive software through Coach Catalyst now. We're literally like, you've taught obviously very different certifications. And it's sometimes hard for me to convey to someone that you're literally buying their system. Like there's no, especially in the stuff you've done, stuff I've done, there's no hidden agenda of we're not trying to upsell you and do 17 other products. It's no, this is literally the system that we've used. Here's how to use it. Here's the context. And in the case of Coach Catalyst, here even the 40 action items are all preloaded into the software. So once you understand it, you can literally drag and drop and add clients to it and start with a system that's already been proven.
And that, I know, to me, what's so important when you think about something like that, right? And this goes into anything from a training perspective, when it comes to behavior change, or even just like client check-ins. When you basically take the author of the book and you then take the book, and everybody does this, they read a book, they hear a podcast, they go, I want to implement that in my life. But when they have the chance to do it, then they kind of like back up a little bit, right? So here they have a chance to take what you actually do with your clients, what you actually do with the coaches that you train and you teach through the certification, and you get to implement it, right? How powerful is that? And then they could put their personality on it. So when you have a system and you have a process, the coach that comes on top of it, it's then becomes their personality that adds to the individualness to the actual program. But you got to start from a process that has been tried and tested. And that's what you're doing here, which is really cool.
Thank you. And it's nice now that you've been around long enough that I wish I would have switched to some software sooner, because I did stuff by paper, which I still do now. I did stuff by Excel spreadsheet for probably way too long. And I knew the breaking point was when Excel kept breaking all my hyperlinks to YouTube for some reason. And I was spending more time like fixing hyperlinks and going back and fixing stuff that should have been in there. That eventually just said, okay, I gotta figure out some better way of doing it.
Well, I think there's a coaching lesson in this too, because software or technology enhances behavior. It doesn't replace behavior. It doesn't change behavior. It enhances behavior. So if someone's disorganized and they get into a project management software or organization or Google Drive, I guarantee you someone who's naturally disorganized, their Google Drive is a wreck, right? I guarantee you somebody who's not really good at, you know, doing things with like a naming convention is going to make a mess on a digital platform. So all they do is enhance behaviors. But if you're somebody that when you're with your client or you're coaching and you're on top of your stuff, basically it takes one pad of paper and it makes sure that it's foolproof. So instead of dropping the ball with sets, reps, or macros, or timing, you now could have consistent behaviors that are tied into a data point that you could then scale, not just across one client to 100 clients, but also the repetition to that same client over and over again without missing anything. I think that's where technology enhances the coaching experience, but you still have to be a good coach first. And if you could layer a good coach on top of technology, that's when you develop like a super coach kind of image.
So you're not afraid of AI overtaking the coaching business then?
I'm not, because I think what they miss, which although all there's humor into it, there's actually a lot of fear. Our world is very fear-based right now with ChatGPT and AI and all of these things that happen. If you think about it, it's augmenting some of the people's biggest weaknesses. So if you bolt on one of your strengths, it then becomes a way to accelerate learning. One of the greatest superpowers that people want is accelerated learning. This is why there's mentorships and books, coaching programs, masterminds, and or events for you to go to so you could spend time with people. It's accelerated learning. All you're doing is collapsing time. You're taking what would take you 10, 20 years to do. Every book is 10 years collapsed into one book. You may take 3 weeks to 3 months to read that. You just collapsed 7.5, 8, 9, 10 years of time to learn it. Now, that doesn't mean you understand it and you have the ability to apply it, but you can now conceptually grasp the idea and then play with it with already knowing what doesn't work, because it does. That to me is what's exciting when you start thinking about AI and you start thinking about like all of the stuff that everyone's got a fear mind about. Technology is going to enhance our behavior. So if you're someone who reads a lot of books, right? Podcasts came around and said, I'm not the best reader and I like listening to people talk. That become a really good learning opportunity to digest content from. And reading a book, it's a single task. You can't read and drive. You can't read and write, right? A podcast, you have the ability to do a higher level task and a lower level task at the same time and just start to consume. So I think that AI is exciting because what it could do is you could put some stuff into it. Like I could take Mike T. Nelson's stuff, drop it into ChatGPT and basically say, use this framework to solve some of these problems. And it will basically use your brain that has already been curated and organized. Now, what's fascinating when you start thinking about books is books to me, that's the baseline, right? That's the filtering mechanism, right? Because the key is like, how do you learn? I'm very long-winded. So how do you learn to write clear, concise, and shorter? And what we're able to do in a book is give somebody like the base. So now they understand the general concept and then we could dive deep with stuff. So if they see us in person, we take those frameworks and then we could get into the practical application because everything is individual and that's where it gets a lot of fun. So I actually love the idea of AI because I think it's going to enhance coaches' behaviors.
Yeah, no, that's a great view. And you mentioned writing and obviously I'm biased because I teach the Flex Diet mentorship. And then one of the things I have people do is like literally write articles and I'll proof them, give you feedback or whatever. And it's amazing how many people, even with students, like this is a ridiculously hard skill because they just haven't been taught. And a lot of the pushback is, oh, I'm never going to write. I'm not writing a book. I'm just going to do videos and dancing TikTok things for 30 seconds. But I think they forget that the process of writing, at least in my experience, enhances your learning and your ability to explain it to somebody clearly. One of the things I've had coaches Absolutely. Do is you can write out all your progressions and regressions for a squat and write out what cues you would use with somebody. Pretty simple. But the process of them going through and doing it and having that in their brain and then okay, edit that down. How many words can you take out and still keep like the same intent? Like you get to edit and you get to simplify. And I think it, like you said, it clarifies your thinking quite a bit.
What's interesting too, because when they talk about note-taking being a great way to retain information, when I go into classrooms, when I go into seminar, I don't take a lot of notes on the subject that they're discussing. I take the notes of the thought that came up that was provoked during the conversation. So for instance, if you and I are discussing something, I go, man, you just connected a dot for me. That's the thing that I'm writing down to remember, but I'm rarely jotting down what you're teaching because that's where the curriculum comes into play. That's where I could go back and go through some of the details a little bit. But there's five things that I tell parents that they should do. I try not to recommend too many things to parents because everyone's like, what's your advice after all these years coaching athletes? But there's five things I recommend parents do with their kids. And number one is make sure your kid reads, because reading is a self-educator. It's so important for the athlete and the individual to learn how to read. Number two is learn a second language. Number three is play an instrument. Number four is play a team sport. And then number five is writing, right?
I like those.
And the thing is that each one of them are autonomous in the learning process, but there's collaboration attached to it as well. And there's immediate reflection regarding kind of accountability attached to the progress of the skill. So for instance, when you're reading, you obviously know how much you retain, number one. And then number two, you know the words that you know or don't know. Number three, you know how fast you read because you can easily count how much pages that you're reading maybe per hour. Easy factors for any kid, even if they're 7 to 17 to 70, knows where things are either progressing or degrading and regarding their abilities. Learning a second language. When you speak in a second language, you hear yourself think, right? You're like, oh, that's what I was saying. That's weird. And it's really cool because what happens is as you're saying something, you're constantly thinking of, am I saying it right? And it immediately makes you a little self-conscious around how you sound. Mm-hmm. So if you think about it, anything that creates a level of self-consciousness that you continue to work through develops actual confidence. So how confident is someone going to be knowing that they've worked through something that's been difficult to them, which is learn a second language, and then use that skill for them to actually present on stage? Very valuable. Playing an instrument. Number one, there's a lot of research done on actually learning and the ability to retain information when you use your hands attached to something and then you're reading it and you're articulating the movement by way of or sound that's on paper, right? Through your hands, which is valuable, right? So things that work with people that are Alzheimer patients, Parkinson's disease, actually work really well with the learning process when you're younger. Sculpting is very valuable. Playing an instrument, extremely valuable. Woodworking, extremely valuable. So these are some of the skills that people say are some of the best skills for people that have like Alzheimer's. You think about like ladder drills and how they're not that important for speed or athletic development, where people argue that all the time. But the reality of it is coordination is really critical for speed development. And the ladder might be fantastic for people learning how to dance, learning how to do a rhythm. It's the same thing with like boxing for people that have Parkinson's. So these elements have transferable effects to the learning process as well as to other benefits throughout the body. Also, so I'm a big fan of them. So each one of the components provide like self-feedback, reflection, and kind of rate of progress, which I think is really critical when you're learning on like with something because it's telling you where you are now, where you're trying to go.
I love that. And that kind of fits in with what we're talking about today with recovery. And one thing I've been, I don't know, I guess not yelling at clients more often, but I keep bringing up more often the past couple of years is, after you do a lot of consults with, especially fitness professionals, it's amazing how focused they are in a good way, but almost at the exclusion of anything that's not fitness. What do you do for fun? Oh, I lift weights. Cool. What else do you do for fun? I don't know. I watch Netflix once in a while. Okay. Like, do you have any hobbies? Do you have any recreation? They're like, no, I go lift weights again. I'm like, okay, I like lifting weights too. I think that's cool. But, and then you look at how much real estate in the brain is just dedicated to movement. And the joke I make is like, how much technology would it take for just a robot to catch a ball that's thrown at it? So like
limited.
Yeah. But yeah.
Tracking depth perception and the ability for it to move around. That's it.
Yeah. But humans do these more complicated tasks relatively easy. And like, you've heard the story of the sea slug, right? A little sea slug, little critter that floats through the ocean, and then it finds its rock and it sticks to its rock and it never leaves its rock. And then it eats its own brain because it doesn't have to move. Food just flows by. And so I sometimes get the impression like we're all becoming more like sea slugs. We're really not using our brain the way that it's developed, especially for the standard fitness person. So you mentioned about doing things with your hands, playing an instrument. Like, I've told clients, like, go play tennis, go play golf, kiteboard, surf, anything. Just do something where the environment is semi-unpredictable. Like, you know what's coming, but you're not like 100% sure. And then do something with your hands. Like, I told a client recently, hey, have you ever tried to build a surfboard? Because he's like super into surfing and foiling and everything else. He's like, no, that would be horrible. It would suck. I'm like,
of course you're going to suck at
first. It's the first one, right?
Yeah, that's the point.
The point is, I think doing something with your hands, creating something, is those things are just tasks that we're missing in modern day now.
Yeah. So one of my favorite coaching lessons that I've ever been on was in Barcelona. I went to the Picasso Museum.
Oh.
And it was fascinating because the light switches didn't have frames around them. And I'm like, that's interesting. I was like, why is that? And they said, anything that like deserving of a frame is art, and that's not art. Oh, wow. That's really cool. And then one of my, like, you look at like mentorship and coaching world, the relationship between Dali and Picasso was fascinating, right? Dali looked up to Picasso, sought him out to become a master at like pointillism, imagery, cubism, and all of these different types of art. And he was an absolute master. If you look at early work of Salvador Dali, you'll see that he was almost immaculate in regarding his ability to like Xerox a print. It was unbelievable. It's super fascinating when you watch his skill set. And that's where his creative genius came in, is because he wanted to create his like his own personality into the art, because everything else was so simplified, because he was able to just literally put it out like a factory press. And he sought out Picasso over the years, and they ended up building a great relationship, and that was like mentor-mentee, and it was so fascinating until one day that Dali sent Picasso a portrait that he made of himself, of him. And Picasso sees this self-portrait now that was made for him. And that day he never talked to Picasso, to Dali ever again.
Really?
The reason for that was the image in which he held himself was not the image actually that his mentee held for him. And I was like, ooh, how are you showing up? It's kind of really, and it's like, that was one of the greatest coaching lessons I've ever received as an athlete, as a coach, someone who basically understands that there's different roles in people differently during different times of your life. How do I show up for those people? That was like a real critical kind of time for me. And instead of taking that coaching lesson from a sport, I took it from a museum, an art. Right? Music has such lessons, and you can see where's the orchestra? Where's the conductor? When you watch a play, right? So you go to an orchestra and you see it, and they're in front of you because that's the show, that's the entertainment. But if you think about just the sound of a play, where are they? They're underneath and they can see the play, but you can't see them. So there's so many different things that are hidden. When I like to go to a play, sometimes I like to go to plays two different times. The first one, I get to watch it head on. And then the second one, I get to watch it from the side.
Oh. Because
optics are interesting, right? There's a parallax, which is like you see things from one angle, but from the other angle, it's a different object. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're wrong or your eyes are lying to you. It's just from your current perspective, that is what you cannot see. So I like to change angles of these things. And these are great lessons that taught me on how to coach. These are lessons that I was able to connect those dots. And I think people in the fitness industry, like you said, they're using such a small amount of the brain. It's because all they're trying to do is collect them. I did this cert. I did that. I know this person. I'm taking a handshake and a picture, instead of connecting the dots between people and realizing that there's a lot of value that this person has to say. And then there's a lot of really interesting things that I'm learning from something completely different and how I can apply it to my coaching. Just most people are not willing to get out of their own way to be able to do that.
Yeah, I think of it as the collectors versus the connectors.
Absolutely.
And usually you can find the collectors because they've done every cert known to man and they've got all the initials after after
like
their
alphabet
signature.
Soup.
Yep. And then you ask them like, oh, how does, you know, RKC relate to Strong First? Or and they're like, like, you did both of them. I see the little signatures here. They're similar. You go into the history of where they came from. And Like for them to, like Nassim Taleb talks about lateral transfer, like for them to move one thing from one area to another is just like a disconnect. And so they just have all this collection, but it's not, I would say, synthesized into a useful output.
Yeah. And that kind of rigidness that they have when they go through people's processes or a system, it basically eliminates the stickiness between you and the client, because people are, they're amazingly adaptable, but they're also humans change. They're different. Everyone is unique in their own way. There's a lot of similarities that you're going to see, right? Like where you could say the same statement, say we're all the same in one way or the other, but we're all very different. And when you could actually start to apply life experiences to your coaching, you're going to connect with your clients significantly deeper, and it's going to have a much more fulfilling relationship between the client and athlete and the client and coach than it will be if it's just at a superficial level. So I tell people, like, I don't do superficial. I like to go deep. I like to be around a small group of people. Even though I'm around a lot of people, there's a small group of people that I trust. And in those relationships, they're very deep. And then they go wide, which is exciting, right? It's one of those things where it's like you could enjoy time with them, because the thought and the just time that passes allows for deeper conversations. But when you want to just go and collect things, like you're referring to, check boxes, I did the certs, instead of where it came from and looking at the history of things, you miss so much, because the applied knowledge is what's the most important thing. And you can't ever get to the application if you're constantly collecting. At some point, you got to pick up the rocks and then actually throw them. You got to skip them. You know what I mean? You don't want to keep them. You want to throw them and see what they're, if they're useful or not.
Yeah, I've often recommended to newer coaches, just do as best you can to be safe, but get some clients, have them pay you money, and like just start. Like, because you'll never feel like you're ready enough. It doesn't matter how many certs you do. It doesn't matter how much stuff you do. Like, you're never going to be ready enough, but the amount of stuff that you'll learn by that person being in front of you. I look back to some of my early clients a couple of decades ago, and man, I feel so bad for those poor bastards. It's such a shit show.
One of my first pros is the director of football operations at the University of Miami. It's fascinating because he's been one that's been like super loyal. He's a great guy. We're literally like family. But the training was definitely not that good. So it's like early on in my career, I had such prolific athletes. I was like dealt basically a really good hand of athletes that I was around. I'm from Miami. I was a high school All-American. I trained with friends of mine that were super athletic and went on to have amazing careers. And then I had the opportunity to coach those guys because they trusted me. And during that time, what was fascinating, it was don't screw it up.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, show us your amazing strategies and coaching ability. It was, I trust you. Don't mess this up. And when I didn't mess it up and they believed that I was everything I did was in their best interest, it allowed for deeper relationships. And they also saw that I was on this like deep pursuit of excellence with everything I did. Even if I couldn't achieve it, I was on it on a regular basis and say, I was going to make sure no stone was left unturned. And every mistake that was made, I owned and said, we're going to make sure it's better. But if you go back and you look at it and it's like, that was pretty rough. I have programs. I literally had every program I've ever written for an athlete. I have it still documented. I know what they did. I also have, I can't remember, you know, what I did yesterday sometimes, but I can remember what that kid lifted or what that kid ran in a specific drill 15 years ago, 20 years ago. So it's a coaching brain.
Yeah. And you mentioned even at the highest level, like the biggest thing is just don't screw them up. Like, I remember my buddy Sean Mishka, I don't know if you know him, but awesome dude. And he was telling me that
stuff with the movement side.
Him and Lauren Landau for just pure movement. Like, those are like my two go-to people for general athletic movement overall. And he was telling the story that he did an internship with the Chicago Bears when Brian Urlacher was there.
Sure.
And first day he's like, okay, you're in charge of him. If he gets injured, just pack your bags and just leave. Don't check in. Just go back home. And then he sets him up to do this like max treadmill test. And he set him up next to one of the other top athletes. And so again, you got these two high level people. And of course, they're looking over to see how fast the next person's doing, trying to beat the person next to him. And Sean's standing there and he's just like going,
oh my God, if this treadmill malfunctions, he's going to fly through the wall and I'm going to be out of here. And he's just, oh, he's just freaking out about it.
That's good stress. That's good stress. But yeah, I tell people all the time. So the day that I don't get that little like butterfly in my stomach when an athlete steps up to the line, I'll probably stop coaching. Other than that, you're going to have to roll me out of the ring. You're going to have to roll me out of the field. You're going to have to roll me out of the oval where I can't coach it on the track side. Because the day that an athlete steps up to run an event, or that whistle's about to blow, or a guy gets in the batter's box and I'm not a little nervous about one of my guys performing, that is the day I'll stop. That is literally the day that I'll be like, all right, I don't have it anymore. But I like that nervous energy because I think I could turn that into adrenaline. Right. If I let it get too much, it becomes anxiety, which a lot of athletes and coaches experience.
But I think that's a good thing, right? You could reframe that and say it's just kind of excitement. And if you don't have a little bit of that, it's, are you really doing your best? Or are you just at the point where you're just kind of phoning it in and you're just like,
Not only do I never want to phone it in, but if you think about it, the athlete's trust is based upon the idea that they've put their life, their career, their journey, their big thing that they love in your hands. And if you don't take that with a level of respect and even gratitude, I think you're doing a disservice, not just to the athlete, but to the experience in which you are going to learn to become your best.
Yeah, 100%. And we're talking about frameworks and stuff here too, which is into the topic of the day, looking at recovery. And I thought you'd be a great person to talk about what is some of the basic recovery, how it's different, and then even some of the advanced recovery. Because I think people would be shocked at the advanced recovery in terms of some of the novel things that are done and some of the incredibly basic stuff that's still done.
I could talk about this subject all day. And I think before we even get started, I think it's critical to understand that everything works until it doesn't.
Yep.
And that it was a lesson that I was taught by Dr. Ken Kanakin, who founded Swiss. And it was fascinating that he constantly would say, oh, that works until it doesn't. Then what? And that's like what drove me down the path of learning all the different modalities on recovery, because a lot of times people think recovery and they're going to go do ice bath. They think recovery and then they're going to go do a massage. These are still stimulus. I run a high, medium, and low model in training from a central nervous system sampling. So if I look at your CNS work, if I'm doing training that's attached to like lifting, so there's four physical qualities: strength, flexibility, speed, and endurance. And if I'm doing speed work, I understand that I could break speed work into high, medium, and low CNS work. I don't break it up into any other category as a subcategory until I break it up into central nervous system work. So if I break it up into CNS work as high, medium, and low, then I'll categorize volume. But I don't categorize volume until I categorize the intensity. And the reason for that is when you look at injuries take place into two areas, mainly they take place in volume and velocity. When those two kind of cross-sect, that's when somebody normally starts to break. And at any point of contact, if the athlete is not in a sound biomechanical position, the risk of injury goes up. So it's my job to understand how and why they would be in a poor mechanical function place. And normally that happens when volume goes up or when we start working in high velocities. So I first categorize their CNS, high, medium, and low. Then I'll categorize their volume of it. And each kind of category has its own like bucket. For instance, in the recovery bucket, I have high, medium, and low stressors to factor into the athlete. A high CNS could be a hot, cold shower. That could stimulate the CNS just as much as it could actually bring you back down if you know how to use it. If you're not prepared for cold showers, ice tubs, hot, cold contrast work, and you're in an environment where you're already stressed, the likelihood of the athlete's immune system actually being suppressed is high, and you could potentially get the athlete sick. And are you more recovered or less recovered when you become ill?
Less.
Of course. Yeah. So with that needs to be factored into your training recovery components. So again, it may work, but when and how much of it? So much, too much is not necessarily a good thing. So it's factoring in those things. And I categorize all my recoveries as high, medium, and low CNS recovery strategies. And then I start picking out which ones I want to use. And we could talk about all the little cool like all the cool little stuff, because it goes from, for me, everyone prioritizes sleep, right? Everybody does. And it's almost one of the very few things I talk to with athletes. Everyone's like, oh, you're a horrible coach for not talking about the athletes. Okay. So I start with nutrition, because with nutrition, I could slow them down, right? So naturally, if someone's eating, they're not eating on the go. Naturally, if somebody's eating, they're going to slow their body down, right? There's the ability for them to say, hey, sit there and chew your food. And I have to almost, some of my athletes, I have to train, like, I want you to chew. They're like, boom, they just scarf stuff down. So I think that if I get an athlete that is always on the go, I don't let them eat like protein shakes. Because I'm forcing a stop. I'm forcing right. things to slow down. And then if I get an athlete that always likes to bring their Tupperware and then likes to do the whole college coach world where they like eat and then grab a Tupperware bodybuilding style, scrounge it in their car and then get back to a session, I force their nutritional strategies to food that doesn't taste good when it's cold. And I'm forcing time. So I'm forcing the, you got to put that in the microwave for 2 minutes and calm the fuck down. So I do simple things like that, because I think the number one factor for, in my opinion, is nutrition. And it's actually time off your feet. So it's not necessarily sleep. And all the studies have shown the people that sleep the longest actually die the youngest. You sleep 8 to 10 hours a day, your lifespan's shorter than someone who sleeps 6.5 to 7.5, 8 hours. That's what all the studies show. Nobody wants to say that though. Everyone's like, ooh, but I heard on this guy's podcast. The truth is that the quality of the sleep matters. Your circadian rhythm matters, right? And these are the things that help basically manage your blood pressure and your heart. So if you look at somebody's sleep like volume, but the quality isn't good, what would you rather have? You want quality.
Yeah. And quality first, then quantity.
Yeah. And if you look at your sleep quality and you factor in how's that affecting your blood pressure, and your person's blood pressure is getting more regulated, they're in a better position. That's very fascinating. The other thing I do is I actually test people's blood pressure and their heart rates post food. So I'll take it before they eat and then after they eat, so you could figure out how their body's adapting to that type of food.
Wasn't that the old, was it COPA pulse test? Wasn't that originally where some of that was from, I think, looking at heart rate spikes after eating food?
Yep. It's something that I found really well with our NFL combine guys when we used to run those programs, is we were like, oh, wow, these guys are like not doing well and they're not able to like come down either. Some guys can't come down. So we look at that like rate of recovery,
is that,
just on their heart rate side.
Related to the food or also just the state that they're in? So
I
let's
think
say
a lot of it is the state.
Yeah. Let's say they were elevated. Is that telling you that maybe the food day was okay, but they're still super stressed and they've got 5 minutes to like inhale their food type thing? So their state is not getting more parasympathetic, more in a relaxed digestive state.
So with some of those athletes, they have a set time period in which they have that kind of window to eat. What we've done is we've dragged that out. And we said, hey, no, you're not going to, everyone used to have the motto where it's drop the weight, pick up the shake.
Yeah.
And that's great for like young high school kids that need to gain weight and they're just starting their lifting careers. But when you start working with like professional athletes that have, their bodies are more sensitive because they're more fine tuned. Everyone's like, oh, my body's more sensitive because I'm out of shape. Or it's actually the opposite. You're more used to eating shit.
Yeah.
So the more fine-tuned athlete, you put one thing in it, you're more aware of what takes place and how you feel. So it's actually like finding a better window for them to eat, getting them to calm down before they eat. And these are all factors in play, because sometimes you go from running your ass off to eating a bunch of food, or eating a bunch of food and then going running, where you have all of this kind of energy focused on the digestive process, and then you're just back up and running. So like even athletes that they like to eat before they train, we make them have a longer warm up. I'll drag it out if I have to. But I have some guys like damn meatheads that like to just get the room and just get after it. They will literally eat while they're lifting. And I'm like, you guys are killing me. And that's why the 300 pounds, shocker, right?
Yeah, yeah, go for it.
So those are some of the strategies that we use when I like start to identify like recovery methods. And then it's also going into, I like to think about anybody, like all things are off the table when it comes to recovery methods, when someone has really good hands. So if someone has fantastic bodywork abilities, you could do that all the time because they could feel it. They could sense the difference. They could have a good understanding of what your person's energy is. and they know what they need to work on. Maybe they're not beating up the tissue. Maybe they're working on it smooth. Maybe they're stretching you out. Maybe they're just getting you to relax, and then they're helping you with some different strategies on the Reiki side or energy medicine side. I think those are very valuable that most people don't think about in the recovery.
Yeah, I find that fascinating too, because if you look at some of the research or some of the evidence-based bros, they're like, oh, massage, hands-on work, all that stuff's bullshit, like manual muscle testing, blah, blah, blah. And yeah, I get some of the studies and everything else. However, I can't really think of an exception to very high-level athletes, especially track and field, sports of any type. Virtually every one of them that I know of has someone that does some type of hands-on work. And these are people who generally know if something's going to make them better or worse.
Yeah, athletes are really good at identifying with what's feeling good for them and making them better versus I didn't like the way that worked.
Yeah.
Some people, like even nutrition, like nutritional strategies, like some people don't work well with certain types of foods and they figure it out. Most elite athletes use food and modalities as utilities, so they don't necessarily have emotional attachments the way general population clients do. That's something I think a lot of people do not take into consideration. I'll give you an example when it comes to body work. I put my hands on most of my elite athletes on a daily basis before their session and after their session to see how, and even during, depending on if it's needed. But if I have a sprinter, for example, if I could put my hands on them and I could treat them and get them ready to go without them expending energy and get them to 98%, and then they just need to do the last 2%, wouldn't that be valuable for their energy kind of ability, like their tank?
Oh, yeah.
If I could put my hands on the tissue and before he gets moving, realize that it's not what it feels like when he's on, how do I actually circumvent that? Now, I can't be like, hey, you're not on today. I got to turn you off. Like, I can be like, all right, cool. Our strategies now change. We got to like ramp up this warm up a little bit. We're going to have to break a sweat a little bit. We're going to have to try hard a little bit. I'm going to have to use some placebo work to get him in the mood a little bit. This is reality. This is reality in coaching. But everybody wants to talk about this is what this evidence showed. Here's my problem with most of those documents on evidence. I train Olympic athletes and pro athletes. That's predominantly it. I got world champion fighters. I have the best in the world at what they do. That's my clientele. How many research studies are done on them? Because I don't know any of my guys that are going to let you test shit on them.
Yeah.
Because if you test stuff on them, you could end their career.
Yeah. So give me your elite athletes and let them run this control program and punch muscle samples out of their VMO a whole bunch of times.
It's like, yeah, it's just not going to happen. No, the best studies that I've seen is actually done on like identical twins that have the same desires and interests. So they look at one program or the other program and they do muscle biopsies. Hank Krasinoff has done that and it's pretty fascinating because he'll be like, oh, you think you're a good coach? You think you're a better coach than him? You two. You run each other's programs, identical twins, 12 weeks. We're going to take muscle biopsies in between, and we're going to find out if the guy got technically better, neurologically better, or you actually changed the muscle.
Yeah, that's awesome.
That's fascinating. That, to me, is fascinating. And that's what he's been able to do with a number of his work. And I think that's what's really cool because that's what makes him the best. But for me, the majority of my clients are not in any study. How many guys ran sub 10 are in studies? That's the people I work with. Because like if we ain't run some 10, we're not winning.
Yeah.
So how many guys forget what they do at the NFL Combine. How many guys are 3-time, 5-time Pro Bowlers that are multiple surgeries, like their bodies are beat up and they got to go perform every single week for 16 to 24 weeks a year?
Yeah.
Guess what they do in the offseason? They do nothing. Everyone's like, oh, we got to train. I'm like, dude, don't train. More strength coaches have injured athletes than ever helped them.
Yeah.
And that's what's scary to a lot of these people because they think that they're doing something good for the athlete. And then the athlete's like, this don't feel good. And they don't listen to their athletes. I have a good dialogue with my guys because they pay me enough to listen for sure. But it is true that in order to know if something's going to work or not, you got to have skin in the game. And research doesn't have skin in the game. And I think that's where I listen to it. I learn from it. I want to know what they're seeing and what's going on. But we found out a long time ago that when people were doing like cryotherapy, they didn't feel as big. And our fighters loved it. It was weird. our big guys liked it when they didn't need to get big, and our fighters liked it because they were like, wow, every time they were cutting weight, they were feeling stronger, whatever. Now, who knows if it was a placebo, but this is long before the study that came out said that it reduces the ability to develop hypertrophy of the muscle. And sure enough, hey, that dumb fighter over there was pretty smart. So it's like, oh shit, that's cool. And these are really cool strategies. Now, cryotherapy and water immersion have very different effects on the body. People don't
realize. What do you find with those two? So the research is very split, actually.
What does the research say? I'd love to know. I don't know.
My interpretation of the research is cold water immersion has a lot more data because it's been around longer. You've got the old military stuff, that type of thing.
Sure.
I didn't have the technology now until recently to do cryo. From what I've seen, cryo seems to have more of a central nervous system, ramps you up, like the endorphin, dopamine type thing. I don't notice any big difference in terms of any marker that I could look at in terms of recovery. It paradoxically may modify inflammation more than cold water immersion. But again, that's based on a handful of studies. And these are in healthy individuals. Pathologies are different. Cold water immersion, as you mentioned, there's 4 studies now showing changes in muscle protein synthesis. Who knows what that means in terms of lean body mass gains? It's across the board. You can't really get a number out of it. Performance, generally, like a couple of the meta-analyses have showed that cold water immersion probably helps performance. Again, what type of performance? You're looking at vertical jump, you're looking at speed, you're looking at power, blah, blah, blah. So yeah, that's kind of what I would look at in terms of the research, but I'm curious as to what you found in practice.
We have found that heart rate goes up higher in cold water immersion and stays up higher on them. We found that in cryo, heart rate goes up quicker, but doesn't drop back down.
Yeah.
We have found hot cold showers to be more beneficial, or like contrast work to be more beneficial than cold water immersion. We have found that there has been more of a like immune suppressant to cold water immersion for athletes that are under high stress environments. So if they use ice tubs or cold water stuff to stress their system when they're already overly stressed, we've seen an actual increase in their overall health because their immune response is actually producing what it needs to and it's fighting back. And then that's another stimulus, even though it's a recovery stimulus meant for, it's still a stimulus. And you have to factor in, as a coach, our job is actually to be not a strength coach, but a stress manager. And that's one of the things that we've found is that we have noticed athletes potentially have gotten sick in camps that they've done a bunch of like ice cold, ice therapy because they're like, let's work on the breathing. Let's do all this. You got to be tough. Let's all this mindset stuff. Like most of the athletes that I deal with, they don't like it. They don't do it.
Yeah.
Some guys that like do it, right? They don't like it. They don't do it. And when you make somebody do something they don't like for the sake of them being tough, they're going to think to themselves, like, how is this going to help me in a fight? How is this going to help me on the field? How is this going to help me in the sprint? But if they believe this is the thing that's going to help me have that pop, this is the thing that's going to help me have that focus, this is the thing that I need to be tough doing, they'll do it. And I think that has a stronger effect on it and the actual physiological changes. Although at the biology level, like in regarding what's happening to the cells, although I'm not certain to it from a research standpoint because it hasn't been done, I have found over 20 years doing this in certain times of the year has a huge effect. I've also found that ice immersion therapy or ice immersion training in cold environments does not have that great of effect. Whereas if you're in hot environments, because your body temperature is warmer much longer parts of the day for a longer period of time. So when you do it in certain environments, it actually has a better stimulus.
So yeah, it's more contrast.
It is. And it's, I find it interesting because a lot of times people don't realize that a lot of these concepts were created in like areas where it's really cold. So that's cold. That's normal for them. They're used to getting into the water. And what's their recovery mechanism actually is the steam bath or the sauna. That's their actual recovery. So we've flipped it because we've Americanized it. And when you Americanize it and you can make money from it, that's when it becomes interesting. But I have found, I'm a sauna guy, but mind you, I like the heat. So I'm the guy that's like, hey, if you want to get the sauna, we'll get the sauna for an hour. I don't care. If I can. I can crush it. I can crush 40 to 60 minutes and be like, why are you leaving? This is normal. But if I had to do 4 minutes in an ice bath, will I do it? I mean, I'm going to be bitching the whole time. And if so, oh, you're not tough because you're complaining, and then I'll shut up. But in my head, I'm still thinking, this sucks. Yeah. But in a sauna, 40 minutes in there doesn't do anything for me in the sense of grueling environment. It's not hard. So what is tough to one person isn't always tough to another.
Yeah. And that's what I think people forget too. Like, I've seen people just completely tank their HRV, go massively sympathetic. One CrossFit athlete in particular a couple of years ago. And I was asking her, I said, what are you doing? I can't figure out, like, your HRV is just like off the ski slope. We didn't change anything. And she's like, I started doing Wim Hof breathing, and then I started doing long cold water immersion. I'm like, oh, so you're super ventilation, like breathing in and out really fast. Gosh. And then getting into cold water. I said, how long in the cold water? So it's like mid 45 degrees for 5 to 10 minutes. I'm like, are you shivering and your teeth are chattering when you get out? She's like, oh, yeah. And I'm like, you realize that both of those are acute stressors, right? She's like, no, I thought this was recovery. I'm like, it potentially can be, but not at the dose or the intensity you're doing. But I think
headache, do you need chemotherapy or Tylenol?
Yeah.
Or maybe some water. So you bring up some really good points, because when you... Here's that, like, I have a lot of people that are in the breathing space. I think breathing is critical for athletic performance, but I think most people overcomplicate it.
Yes.
So let's get into breathing for a split second, because I think it really could help. And I think that a lot of people could actually play with this and see if it works for them. Simple box breathing, right? So if I'm literally treating it like it's a box, so I'm going basically breathing, I'm breathing in for, let's say, a three count. Three, right? And I'm bringing it slowly. So I'm going one, two, three, breathing in, right? Box is going across, holding it, right? For three, and then breathing it out for three. Three, and then holding it, and then doing it again. Simple box breathing. You could choose whichever number that you're comfortable with as you're listening to this. If you are feeling like you need to calm down, you actually want to start with a faster number. Quite opposite that everyone thinks, right? So if you want to calm down, you want to start with a faster number. So we're going to go one, hard one, out one, hold one, right? And then I want to work my way up to two, to a longer number, to a point where I'm doing a box breathing of five. So it's one, two, three, four, five, hold for five, four, three, two, one. Exhale, push it all the way out in five, hold for five and bring it across. And then you'll calm down. Because when you restrict the pipes, right, and you hold things down, it's waiting to come out, right? And then all of a sudden, when you then get it to calm down, it's a lot smoother. So what I do is I have somebody who ever wants to like move, if they have too much anxiety, right, and I need to get them to calm down, breathe with it a little bit so it matches their mental state fast, and then slow it down. And then if you want to build it back up, take a deep breath in and then build it up, right? So increase your box breathing at the rate in which you want to actually get into actively wise. Very simple. You don't need to worry about Wim Hof. You don't need to learn anything. It's very simple, and play with it. What you'll find is you're going to figure out something that's going to work for you. But most people haven't even played with it, right?
Yeah.
So I'm a big believer in like doubles and triples. So, and that you let it out, because you'll get a lot of value out of that. It'll also calm people down, but yeah, you can affect
physiologic side.
I play with the ears a lot. I'm into a lot of meridian lines, Chinese medicine, acupuncture points. I find that they're very beneficial if you know them. Acupuncture is an amazing recovery tool. There's a ton of people. Dr. Shealy, he has created essential oils that he's used on different points and meridian lines that has helped change basically your heart rate and just meridian flow tremendously. It's unbelievable what people could do. Dr. Ken has put a lot of like magnets in different parts of like your body to actually change the effect. Huge in regarding impact. When I treat an athlete, a lot of people use like electric ENS, like TENS pads. Most of my stimulation units have those like sticky pads that everyone's used when they're in high school, and they've lasted all the way through college. The majority of my TENS pads and EMS pads and all of my electrical stimulation units actually transfer most of that stimulation through actual natural rocks. So I'll use like shungite stones. I'll use minerals, and basically they actually hold an elective charge. And then we have to tape it or wrap it to the body, which then gives me another added benefit, because I will tape it with infused tape, or I'll wrap the area in some sort of an far infrared infused structure that allows for a better healing thing. I'll actually have someone sit on while I'm doing manual therapy on them, or even stretching a PEMF mat. So when I'm doing my treatment on somebody, I have them laying on a PEMF mat. And that's very, very valuable. When I'm working with somebody, or if I'm just talking to an athlete, passive strategies for recovery are very valuable and underutilized. So I have them sit on a grounded mat and they don't even know it. And they're just like, man, I feel so good here. I use mountain blood, which is Mumio, right?
Yeah.
It's a fantastic tea. It's really hard. It looks like sap. And you just crack a piece off, a little small dime field, drop it in hot water, make tea out of it. Hey, sit down, talk to me.
Very black, tarry, yep. Correct? Yeah.
Yeah. And I'll just be like, hey, sit down, talk to me. And they don't like, man, this doesn't taste bad. It's fine. They just drink it. It's hot tea, whatever. You could throw some ginger, some lemon, whatever you want to like flavor it up for them. But they're feeling better. And I like to infuse all of this stuff, right? I play a little fun game with you with the little coasters. Bring those to a bar and have their little party tricks where you can basically change the actual liquid structure, organizing the liquid and actually changing the way something tastes, all through the reflective image of a color, which is really cool. Now, if you ask me how to explain it, like, I'm not Elon Musk, so don't worry about it. Try it for yourself. And if it doesn't work, you still got a shot of vodka or bourbon. So
yeah,
on you.
Oh, good.
So I'm a big fan of that. If you have minerals, crystals, it's just the same thing. I don't think there's a lot of difference between healing energies that are natural than internal healing of like herbs and spices. I think that they're very similar and the body just needs to receive them. So you have to play with that stuff, but there's so much that you could go down that rabbit hole that's super exciting about.
What PEMF like kind of mats do you like? I know there's a whole bunch. There's from... Yeah. Pretty basic ones to ultra high end, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 industrial looking units.
So the one I have a bunch of them, right? Like I really do. I have a bunch of toys. One of the everyday mat I use is a mirror mat. That's what it's called.
Okay.
And the reason why is it's a super low dose, right? A lot of times people think that you need to crank this stuff up. Some of the patients I work with, if they're at the elite athlete level, that's one thing. They can receive that really high jolt. But again, don't forget, that's still a high stress.
Oh, yeah.
Even if it's giving you energy, right? It's still a high stress. I can walk into Dr. Serrano's office and he's laying down a PEMF machine that's used for fucking horses and he's getting shocked and he feels great and he's half asleep. He's literally knocked out snoring, right? And he's getting shocked by this thing. But it's for horses. And that's the difference. Whereas a lot of the athletes, I like people to not know that it's happening and let them know, hey, what you're on is very special. Here's what it does. Educate them. Like, I don't even feel it. Wow. But I do feel better. You can get them to believe in it, which is, I think, part of the work that we do. But the mirror mat is my favorite one. It's a super low dose PEMF. And I found great results with it. They also have Mirror Magic, which are like these little small devices that are mobile. I've used that for like bone healing, putting it around like any sort of joint or bone, if that has like any sort of fractures or any injuries. I've had a lot of success with that. The mat that I use, you could even sleep on it. Here's what I have found. My son's 5. He loves the mat if he's not feeling well. In the middle of the night, my wife will be like, oh my God, that's crazy. Like at the middle of the night, he'll get to a point and he'll just slide slightly off of it. That's it. So when his body's ready and he's done, he'll just move off of it.
Yeah.
He'll be out the whole night right there. And then some days he'll stay the whole time and sometimes he'll slide right off. So I like that. There is a ring by Dr. Norm Shealy that was just created that has different wavelengths that Dr. Ken brought to me. When I was going through, I went through a bout of about 12 days of getting around 2.5 hours of sleep max. Now, I don't sleep much. I sleep about 5.5 hours a night on average. Sometimes I could get up to about 6.5 on a good day. My wife is amazing and she lets me sleep in on a Saturday when I'm in town and I'll like crack out like a whole like 9 hours sleep and I feel like a zombie. But I was struggling. It was a good 12 solid days. And then the last 2 days I pulled like hour and a half moments. And I was like getting to the point where I'd wake myself up and I had real bad insomnia. And he used the dolphins on battlefield acupuncture on my ears, which if you guys are not familiar with acupuncture, it's like the first book I would have you guys read. It's a pink book. And I don't recall the name right now, but I'll definitely send it to you.
Yeah.
And it's just the points inside the ears and it's unbelievable. And then he put that device on me. And then he had me literally lay down with some stones and I slept for 11 hours.
Was the dolphin, did he just zap the points or did he have it on the continuous to like the point for kind of the parasympathetic?
No, he just worked on those points. He did not do that. And he didn't use the valgus nerve stuff, which I think is very valuable. I'm a big fan of Alpha Stem as well. But I do think if you have a dolphin, the dolphin is actually significantly more powerful for valgus nerve work on the ear. I think it's got a better attachment. I think it does a really good job. And I really like the Alpha Stem. But Alpha Stem, you need a doctor's prescription for.
Yeah, dolphin you can buy over the counter. I've had one for 7 years now, I think 6 years. And quick story with that, like I did the scar training for it. That's how I originally got into it. So
that's freaky too, because you do it and it's immediate. You're like, holy crap.
It's the weirdest thing ever. So I was at the Swiss conference maybe 5 years ago now. And a guy, Dr. Bruce, doing this booth, and you hear this like zapping noise and he's zapping all these people. And you walk by, you're like, what the hell? And so I saw one of the guys come over. His ankle looked like a tree stump, just all craggly, horrible looking. Goes through, does all this stuff. And you could see what looked like massive scar tissue turn almost like bright pink and looked like blood flow back into it. The guy's like, oh my God, like the pain went down and just see a couple of crazy things go by. And so I get up there and he's, hey, what do you got going on? I said, oh, I've got a midline scar I had from open heart surgery when I was 4 and a half. He's like, oh, okay. He's like, take your shirt off, lay down. And he looks at the scar and he goes, what's this from? I said, I had an atrial septal defect repair when I was 4 and a half years old. He's like, oh, this will change your life. And I'm like, okay, whatever. This guy is like some weirdo, whatever.
He's a bit abrasive.
Yeah. So you met him, obviously. So he zaps the scar, does a whole bunch of other stuff. And I'm asking him, I said, hey, like, how does this thing work? He's like, it helps regenerate ATP and your autonomic nervous system will be quite different. I'm like, oh, really? He's like, oh, yeah, you'll be much more parasympathetic. And I said, oh. I said, what happened to measure my HRV each day? So can I come back tomorrow and show you my HRV and see what I found? And at this point, like most people would be like, oh, it doesn't really do. I'm not so sure. And he's like, oh, yeah, cool. Let me know. I was like, oh, that's oddly confident, knowing I'm going to show up here tomorrow and be like, hey, here's what I found. Yep. So towards the end of the day, I've been traveling. Went back and I was just super tired after that. I was just like out. Go back to my room, go to bed early. And I woke up the next day. My HRV went up 14 points and my heart rate dropped by 7 beats per minute, which especially being stressed at a conference and travel, like nothing good ever usually happens there. Yeah. And so I come back to him and I'm showing it and he goes, oh yeah, that's what we thought. And so I'm like, okay, I'll buy two units, please, sir.
Yeah, he's pretty incredible. He's got a typical doctor's bedside manner who's a bit of a savant, so that makes sense.
Yeah.
Kelly's actually really good too, so those are good people. Yeah. I've seen some of their clients that have gotten tattoos of the points that they need to hit so they can have partners, and they're older and they just go, hey, hit here, hit here, because they have to be grounded. But when things work, you start to use them. So I use a lot of scanner devices, Russian scanner devices. One of my favorite ones is the Dove. It stands for Device Organizing Vital Energy. I spent a lot of time with Dr. Arena and I've learned so much about the technology. I've learned so much about it. It becomes like, to me, it's like playing an instrument. I know it so well. So sometimes some of these tools, you do got to get used to them, right? It's just like your hands, right? A therapist needs to get used to their hands, but they're not willing to practice. A coach needs to get used to his voice, but they're not used to coaching. And the recovery side of all of this stuff is just a matter of playing with it. Obviously, you don't want to ever break glass, but most of these modalities, most of these training recovery tools, you got to experience them yourself. If you're a coach listening to this and you've never done breathing, if you've never talked to chiropractors that have a lot of different strategies for them to help heal their clients, you need to open up your mind to this because it will make a massive difference in their impact. Sound is critical to rehabilitation. I met a lady just the other day who She is a multi-million dollar company doing these like sound cones where she like just hits them and she's, hey, here are all the frequencies.
Like a sound bowl type therapy.
Sound bowls. Yeah. She said, that's what she sells. And I was like, how are you doing? She's like, oh, it's a $3-4 million business. And we just started.
Damn.
Goodness. Got the wrong market, man.
Yeah.
For all these yogis. But one of the other things that was fascinating is you look at sound, you look at light, right? I'm a big fan of red light therapy. Huge fan of red light therapy.
Got one right here, actually. Yeah.
I find them to be so valuable. By the way, that is like research backed. You could argue that all you want. And it's like, all right, let's just test you. And it's something that is so valuable. I highly recommend it. And when you do it with like little kids, I remember because I use a lot of like low level lasers, like cold lasers, different things, and with different enhancers so that you could actually hit different areas. But what's cool is like resonating frequency in light doesn't need to be deep penetrating for you to absorb it, because the largest organ that absorbs it is your skin. You're going to get it, which is really exciting. And your body could start to reject it if you ever get too much of it. So this is not going to have the ability to burn you, but your body will slowly start to stop receiving it. You know, amazing what happens. You can actually see like the pores change or different things. I love it for people that have like skin issues, people that have acne, people that are going through like breakouts because of any sort of allergic reactions with medications. And you'll be like, all right, cool. This person's allergic to something. They eat something, take their shirt off, put it like a kid that's allergic to something, take their shirt off, put them by a light. And it's literally like, okay, try it. So for those of you that haven't tried it, try these things, right? So I'm a big fan of them. I like oils. I think there's so many things in like natural medicine that we have not used for our elite athletes that if we did, we could make big impacts. So like natural oils, magnesium oil is something that I treat most of the athletes with from a range of motion standpoint. So anybody that's dealing with like tension in their hamstrings, or if I need to loosen them up, just get a little bit of magnesium oil, do the treatments with magnesium. So if I am actually treating an athlete's body and I need them to loosen up, that's where I'm hitting it. Now, I rarely treat the lower back with magnesium oil because I don't want the lower back to loosen up. Like I want to get in there with maybe the coconut oil so I can actually feel it a little bit and then move around. But there's so many things that you could use dual purpose while things are happening. So passive recoveries with lights and sounds, things like that. And then also in the treatment side, right? So instead of just using a piece of plastic tape, use something that has some sort of a healing power to it. I'm a big fan of like a Rife machine. I think Rife machines actually work really well. I think they're like banned by certain doctors in certain states because they were, God forbid.
Explain what that is for people who are not familiar with it.
Oh my goodness. So Dr. Rife was a chiropractor, and I'm going to be messing up the stories, but it's said to say that we'll say this on a podcast as an urban myth or an urban legend, so I don't get in trouble, right? But basically there was a device that he created, which was a signal that was put out and supposedly cured cancer. And it basically killed the cancer cells without harming the other cells, because it understood that these cells lived up to a certain frequency. The right frequency would go in there, hit the cell, similar to a microwave. So for people that understand how a microwave works, microwaves go from one side to the other side. And the reason why your mom and everybody always put like a little bit of water or a towel with a little bit of water on top is because what it actually does is it actually heats up, vibrates the water, which is what breaks it up and causes the heat. If there's no water or liquid inside the food that you're heating up, it won't heat up at all. So if you go to put something in the microwave that isn't actually hydrated at any capacity, it won't get hot. It will stay cold because that's what it's doing. So where a lot of people like, I was taught, get away from the microwave, Justin, you're going to get cancer, you're going to die. That's not what actually happens, right? So what a Rife machine does is it understands the frequencies that are at certain levels in cells and where they are healing and or where they are in disease states. And it pushes the frequency to that point into where basically those cells, which also allows for ways in which it could help and heal you as well. So that's what a Rife machine is in the most elementary view from a non-doctor, a mythological statement of someone who cured cancer, so you don't get in trouble on a podcast. I do know with confidence that I've literally seen athletes that have had broken bones get treated, and within a week of treatment, with nothing else, literally have a bone that was healed. I've seen ligaments. I've seen athletes that are sick I've seen some amazing things. There's a device called the Spooky 2. It's probably the best Rife machine that I know on the market. And the versatility of it is unbelievable. So there's a ton of stuff that they do. They could literally do DNA frameworks on it, which is like way outside of my league. I'm lucky enough to have a group of people that help me with that process. For instance, I have Hank. When you have somebody like that, that you could call and walk you through stuff, it's awesome. And then it's even awesome because his athlete, Rennell, she's getting her doctorate degree in plant steroids. So she's a genius. And she basically will walk you through like exactly how to use it and what setting and everything else. So it's like sometimes you just let the people that are the best at it teach you, and then you play with it and you get some really good results. I like using different modalities, but I also think that there's so much value in also, like you're talking about, like nutritionals from a healing standpoint, right? So I'm a big fan of high dose vitamins, high dose supplementation to heal different parts of the body and recovery. And I don't think a lot of people are used to it. You could just use like currant seed oil, and the typical dose is 2. And I'm like, hey, I tell the athlete, take 10 every hour on the hour. I'm like, what?
What?
And they're like, I feel like Superman. I'm like, awesome. I thought you were feeling like crap. It's about as good as taking Aaron. And there's other things that I think are very valuable. Peptides are fantastic if you know what you're doing.
That's a whole area.
Yeah. And it's getting more popular now, which is making it even worse. But if you could get with people that know what they're doing, peptides are phenomenal. I've seen them do amazing work. I've seen literally tears from muscles heal a whole chest. I've seen somebody literally like tear a hamstring and do treatments. I had an athlete that I told would tear his hamstring if he kept doing something. He did something, tore his hamstring. What's fascinating about this athlete is he was so professional that like when I called him, he called me and he's like, yeah, I need you, Kev. I'm like, all right. I was like, here's the first thing I want you to do. Like literally it happened the day of. So I get a phone call. I was like, hey, here's what I want you to do. I want you to schedule your PRP session like tomorrow. I already did. I just got out of the doctor's now. Just got a shot. The kid is on point. So at least at that, even at, like after shit broke, he was on point, which I appreciate.
Totally.
I just hope for athletes and coaches to take it just as serious before it happens. And then we brought him in. So you just got his PRP, you put peptides in there, you get that kind of rocking and rolling. I'm a big believer of laser. I wrap it in an infused tape that has tourmaline crystal in it. It has healing power. And then I'll also basically use different types of therapy throughout the night to help them with the healing process. So for instance, put them on a PEMF mat, right? And wrap the entire leg in it. So it's like a cocoon. There's space blankets that you could reflect any negative energy out and you just wrap it around that. So now everything is encompassing inside that area. Within 10 days, I took a 3 millimeter tear in the hamstring to a complete recovery, both from the beginning of the MRI to 10 days recovery on the MRI. That athlete got tested twice by the NFL for any sort of drugs. Everything we used were natural modalities, and they had never seen a hamstring heal that fast before.
So that's wild.
Is it like cool stuff? Yeah. But if it works,
yeah.
And these guys are worth millions of dollars, they're going to use it.
Yeah. And that's the thing that to me is always fascinating, because you're dealing with people who basically money is not really an object. It's how fast can I get back within the confines of the rules of the organization that I'm in to play again. Yeah. So you, by its nature, you have to find things that work. And even if they sound weird and woo-woo, if that was me and I was an athlete, I wouldn't give two hoots about how it sounded. As long as it worked and it was in the confines of the rules, cool, I'm in.
There's so much to the environment that plays into building trust with an athlete and letting them know that, hey, no stone will be left unturned if you work with me. We're going to do everything. So, hey, once something happens, if there is some sort of a break, an injury or a problem, like hitting it from every angle it doesn't do any harm. Maybe it'd be wasted effort where it doesn't make a big of an impact, but it does no harm. So red light therapy isn't going to hurt you. Sauna and or water immersion isn't going to hurt you. So is it taking away? No. Is it helping? I don't know. I'm not certain, but I know it's not hurting you. So we're going to throw everything we can at it. We knew this one athlete, a different athlete that broke a bone, responded really well to peptides. So I slapped an insulin pump on him with the peptide mixed, and we pumped it every hour on the hour. That was it. And within days, x-ray, no broken bone. And everyone's like, what did you do? Yeah, I took the dose that you should be using once every 12 days, and I did it in 12 hours, but he's fine. And all the other organs are healthier too. So it's not like it's a negative. There's no negative byproducts unless it's being misused and mismanaged. But this is all being oversought. Like the oversee that I have in my team is by all of the Olympic and pro coaches I have too. It's not me. I might be doing like some of the advisory work. I might be basically saying, hey, we need to bring these people in. But the team of doctors I have is probably more doctors I have on my team than people have probably ever dealt with their entire life. We may have 4 to 6 doctors on a single case, you know, so it's not like we're just like haphazardly throwing shit at the wall. We just understand that this athlete is worth a lot of money and he is not going to bear an expense to be able to get himself healthy. So I'm a big believer of it. And when you create environments that they have that level of like trust and transparency between the people, you can move really fast. For instance, an athlete comes in. Yeah, we talk about putting them on the seat. We talk about creating a good environment. We talk about good light. Man, just put music on that they like. You'll be amazing how much stronger they are. You do muscle testing. Muscle test people with music that they like and versus they don't like. It's mind-blowing. Essential oils, mind-blowing what it does. But again, everybody will like, they don't want to hear that shit. I don't know if it's going to help you pull a PR, but I know that it will help you with that pulled muscle.
Yeah. And I've got another podcast I did with Dr. Ryan Green from Monarch Health, along with Dr. Andy Galpin, where we talked all about peptides and if people are listening, what do they do? How do they find them? Because unfortunately, as they're becoming more popular now, they're still considered a gray area.
Sure.
And a lot of the stuff that people can get is hopefully sterile and inert at best of worst, I guess you could say, or not real and all that kind of stuff. But
like everybody is going to say 99% pure.
Of course they're going to say that.
The problem is the 1%.
Right. What's the other shit in there?
Like the 1% is the problem. The 99% is not. So that's the big thing. The other thing to think about is for novice that don't know the difference, do you really want to experiment with low quality or would you rather be working with the best on the market? See, I don't have to worry about that because everything I do is going to be done at least with the intention of the highest level, but because expenses are not necessarily going to be the resisting
of that. Not the rate limiter.
No. And what is time and speed and deliverability? And you might be able to eat. You might be able to have a whole bunch of things and take it in on nutrient side, but are you absorbing it? So we want to make sure that quality precedes the quantity. Because I find that the quality of stuff could enhance the recovery tremendously. And I'm a big believer in that. And just look at, for those that have ever taken a European trip and ate bad food, right? Because you guys have a psychology in your head that's broken, bad food. You guys ever went to Europe, ate bad food and felt great? And when you come home and you eat good food and you feel like shit, what does that tell you about the quality of our food? Why can you go to Europe and eat pizza and bread and everything and you can't have anything here?
Yeah. And part of that goes, I think, back to the state we were talking about before, too. A lot of people are there. They're more relaxed. They're not working. They're like, hey. So their state is completely different, too. Because I've had that happen with a few clients and I'm like, okay, so let's try to recreate the state that you were in over there or on vacation when you're at home. And let's start with that and see how you do. Most of them do better.
Here's an interesting way to test that is if you have a morning routine where you have a cup of coffee and every day you have a cup of coffee, but you're working from home or you're doing something and you just do it in a rush. Instead of doing that, find a window, find a seat outside, find something that's quiet. And go have that exact same cup of coffee with zero distractions in a completely different environment while you're looking have the ability to look very far away. Because I believe that proximity to your body and sight is actually really critical for your brain because your brain is just your eyes are just like internal, external organs. And you need to be able to have the ability to look far and near away to relax yourself. I think these are easy tests that you could do if you actually want to test your heart rate. Is just like looking different far away and close. And I guarantee your heart rate will slowly come down. You could do this with like tension and tightness in like different parts of your body as well. Put something close to you, look at it, and then stretch. You're going to feel tighter. So again, states are critical. But when it comes to food state, if you actually look into the nutritional biochemistry part, look at the gut-brain axis, look at the microbiome, and the actual change that happens when you're in different states when you eat something. Significantly different, right? And again, I'm probably not the expert at that, and there's plenty of people that I'm talking to right now that may be, that you have a lot of things that you could opine on because you understand it from a holistic view, that you know that some of these things aren't going to be the easiest wins. So you want to start with the easiest wins. And if environment is the easiest win, how much is that first domino going to create the rhythm and momentum in which you're going to actually get the result that you want? Because at the end of the day, we're results driven. So whatever the first domino is that's going to push it down, that's going to then steamroll into the thing that we want to achieve. And if you start your conversations as a coach with, you're never going to recover unless you get 8 hours of sleep. The hardest behavior change that we have, you might as well tell a person that you're going to die tomorrow if you don't quit smoking. We know they're going to die, but that's not going to kill them. So you got to start with some sort of behavior change. You got to start with some sort of action that actually gets them in a better position to start resting. So for me, I'll tell them that instead of sleeping, I'll say, hey, I don't care what you do. You got to get off your feet. So my rules are get off your feet. I don't want you standing. I don't want you walking. I don't want you moving. So being off your feet is critical. I'm a big, big believer of that. And there's so many different things that we see that are completely misrepresented in the sport performance, trainer, exercise science, strength and conditioning world. A good example for all these coaches that are like barefoot coaches, I love barefoot work. I love the foot moving around. But if you look at the body, if it's got a soft surface, it needs to get hard, right? Because if you're soft and soft, what happens? You just crumble. If you have a hard surface, then it can relax. So we always talk about, oh, you need to wear these Vibrams. You got to wear these. There's nothing wrong with wide-based shoes. There's nothing wrong with moving your toes around. I think that's fantastic. There's a time and a place for everything. Don't use that on the sport field. You'll break your foot. But people don't realize that. There's a reason why no NBA player is wearing tennis shoes. There's a reason why no NBA player is wearing sprint shoes. It's a tool, and it needs to protect both the bones and the joint structures so that it can perform its task. The most mobile foot of the five major sports that we have in the United States is what sport?
Five.
So if you got like baseball, football, soccer, hockey, and basketball, out of those five sports, which foot do you think has the most pliability and the most control of their toes?
I would guess soccer.
Exactly. Guess one has the most rigid foot? Soccer.
Yeah.
This one has the loosest foot, the most control, the most managed ability of their dexterity of their toes? Hockey. Which has the most movable cleat? Soccer. Why? Because technically, when you kick a ball, you need to roll the ball. You need to curl your toes. You need to be able to move so that the foot has to move. In hockey, you need a hard skate, right? And your foot and your toes push down, and that's how you skate. But again, these are things that we teach and we hear in theory, but in practicality and in reality, which is the world I live in, when there's skin in the game, you learn so much because you say, hey, hockey guy, he can move his toes around like a monkey. And the soccer kid's got like barely any dorsiflexion with the big toe. The foot's messed up. The ankle's all calloused over because it's been rolled up on a gazillion times. So the recovery modalities for those things sometimes aren't what we think.
Yeah. And you have to deal with the constraints of the system, right? No one's going to design a hockey skate that just looks like your foot strapped to a blade with no protection. So the reality is you're dealing with like a hard boot system. That's just the reality of the sport, and you can't really change that either. Because I think some people get,
if that was the case, if a soft boot, a pliable boot, a foot plate that actually had the ability to move around would make them a better hockey player and safer hockey player, they would have already done it. If making a running shoe into a basketball shoe would have made someone faster, they would have already done it. The reason why they haven't done it is because they know it doesn't work. The problem is on the training side, we're so disconnected from reality that we end up actually evaluating our stuff from our keyboard, not actually with our boots on the ground and hand in the dirt. Like, we got to see it in practice and go, oh shit, that's what that means. But most people aren't willing to do that.
Yeah, like we said at the beginning of the program, try something out, see what the results are. I remember something our good buddy Cal Dietz said. He's like, yeah, I try all my new programs out on all my track and field athletes and my swimmers because I know if they got faster or not. He's my hockey players. I don't know. Unless we do some other type of testing, I have to have something that's repeatable that is at least one of the parameters of a sport to know if they're going to be a better athlete or not, because that can involve a whole bunch of other things too.
Yeah, track, Olympic weightlifting, and swimming are the controlled environment settings that allow for you to actually know if you're doing a good job inside the weight room. And yeah, there is a lot of technical changes to those sports, but all things being equal, that is the best place to measure your performance on the sports transfer side. And why aren't you as a coach being like creative and curious with these things? Probably, like you said in the beginning, because you're so stuck in fitness and training and nutrition and lifestyle work that you have no hobbies that you could pull from.
Yeah.
I had the luxury of working with Kravitz early in my career, and I got a chance to go see him not too long ago, a couple of years
ago. Oh, awesome.
With my wife at Wolf Trap, and I watched him literally on stage slip, and he hurt his back. And I knew it because I watched it. And I'm like, I know it because I know what he does when he gets mad. And I know his little, I don't want what's going on right now, mannerisms. Nobody noticed except for me. And I'm just like shooting him a message like, hey, man, are you still in? He's like, I'm off to London. I wish I would have seen you. I'm like, dude, like I saw what happened. How's your back? He's like, dude, it's a wreck. I wish I could have still been there. And I'm like, here's one of the coolest dudes in the world. And it's just like noticing that little nuance. But observation is what makes you better as a coach. And then doing it makes you more confident. Observation is going to make you better. Doing it in practicality is going to build your confidence. And then when you actually start to have conviction with your athletes, you're going to start to see major changes happen. And it's also the same thing with the recovery. But I think the big picture of this conversation is, what are you doing outside of your world that you could pull from? And if you have nothing outside and that's all you're doing, then you know, you're probably going to be limited in your mind. This is why we're all like the creatives come from places that they're probably on something and they're experiencing different things in the world. The truth is some of the same creative nature could come from conversation with really good people. Some of this creative stuff comes from music. Some of it could come from art and environments. Go to different places. You could see some amazing things and you could pull from it.
Yeah. What I do with that is I think of low movement and high movement environments, right? So low movement environment for me, if I'm trying to solve a problem or run questions through my brain, I'll lock myself in like a float chamber for 90 minutes. So I'll literally try to remove all other stimulus and then I'll get out and I'll just write stuff out for sometimes like an hour afterwards.
Nice.
And then
awesome.
If there's other things I'm trying to solve, I'll also do like a high movement strategy. So in a perfect world, I'll read a whole bunch of stuff, literature, and then I'll normally just go kiteboarding for a couple of days. I won't look at any of that literature. I won't actively think about it, but I know I'm subconsciously processing it. And all of a sudden, things will just show up and I'll just make a note. And so I'll have a couple pages of the notes after a few days. And then I'll go back again to the process of, okay, I want to look up this, I want to look up that, and then just reiterate some of those things.
That's fascinating because for me, it's like fighting, jiu-jitsu, boxing, wrestling.
Yeah.
In that area. And then on the opposite end, it's scuba diving.
Yeah, yeah. Same idea.
So it's like you, because what happens is like you hear your own thoughts when you're scuba diving.
Oh yeah. It's crazy.
And I'm like, I sound like that. Like I could hear my thoughts. That's scary because you're not talking. But it's so interesting to give yourself space and disconnect from that stuff. I did a thing for a year, Jim Quick. Who's the memory guy, is a friend of mine, and he's fascinating human too. But he used me for 1 year to do it, and I did it. And it was for the first hour of the day, do not look at your phone.
Oh, yeah,
first
yeah.
First hour.
Now, yeah.
I'd be lying if I say I'm doing it now, because I don't. But I did it for one full year, every single day for a year. I did not pick up my phone for the first hour. And it was fascinating. It made a huge impact in my mood. It had a huge impact in my presence. It made a huge impact in my relationship. And it was very noticeable to the point where just a couple of weeks ago, my phone broke and I had to give it to Apple to fix. And they're like, you could bring it back tomorrow or you could just leave it overnight and be ready in the morning. I just left it overnight. And then my wife is just like, how are you doing? Are you okay? You don't have your little toy. You don't have your little like, extra girlfriend with you. And it's so true because that thing that kind of ties us down that we're so glued to is actually tying us to some of the wrong things. And it removes the ability to be present. And you got to take that away sometimes. So probably need to get back to doing that. But that was a challenge that Jim Quick gave me and I did it. And I'll tell you what, it was probably a significant, one of the biggest changes I had in regarding a morning routine, because I'm not a big morning routine guy, that I made a big deal.
Yeah, I noticed right now as we wrap up that because I had the Fizz Flex cert, when this will air later, but it was opening, now it's closing as of this recording tonight. So I've tried to be more
get on it. If you don't hear it, get on it.
That's right. Thank you. And so I tried to be more on social media. People had questions, trying to be more responsive. So I go on a couple times, 3-4 times a day. And I noticed every single time as it's ending, like I literally feel like I give myself squirrel ADHD brain, because like I get in the habit of being distracted. And like you almost look forward to them being distracted. So the amount of times during the day, I'll be like, oh, you know, I should see if someone sent me a message on Instagram about this or that. And so then I have to almost like detox my way off like the next week of, okay, stuff's on autopilot. I'll write for the newsletter. Someone else will post it. I try to set up not looking at email first thing in the morning, do some red light, do some meditation, a little bit of cardiovascular stuff, and then have my 1 to 2 hour block of the big tasks where I actually have to think, obviously helping with the triphasic two book is the main one right now, and try to get through those things. Because I find as soon as you start allowing your brain to be distracted, it's much harder to then carve out those kind of uninterrupted spaces again.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think it's one of those things similar to athletes where a good athlete knows how to get out of a bad position. A great athlete gets in one. And what's really cool is it's also when it comes to sprinting or movement, if you start in a good position, it's so much easier than to find a good position if you start in a bad one. So how can you start your day? How can you start your environment in better positions so that it's easier to build momentum? And it's the same thing with the changes that you're trying to make with your athletes or your clients. How can you do that by way of making it easier for them, not easier for you as a coach? And that's something that I think is pretty fascinating. That's why with Coach Catalyst specifically, you could prompt your people to do things and then also see that work. So you get a way of identify where their behavior changes. And most people do not identify change. So they don't notice that they made a significant change. Other people notice it. But if you could actually use every single person's action as the way to manage the accountability for their change, it becomes self-reflecting and they become better at self-awareness and appreciation and gratitude, which are all very important and things that we probably don't see enough of as coaches.
Yeah. And a lot of that you could even tie back to position. So the biggest thing I learned for kiteboarding, my goal this trip or coming up is to hit a jump at 20 feet up. So I've hit almost 18 feet before for about five, six seconds, right? So you land about 160 feet away from where you took off. And the biggest thing I learned was, oh yeah, if you go off in a stable position, odds are you'll probably land pretty good. But if you go off just all fucked up, like trying to correct all that stuff as you're sailing through the air, it's really, and it's one of those things that sounds so obvious about position. But like for years, I got really good at just setting the kite and I'd go off in all these messed up positions and couldn't figure out why I could never land anything. And then one day I took a lesson and the guy's like, maybe you should work on just going off in a stable position. I was like, oh, shocker. How simple. But again, it's those simple things, having an outside source go, hey, you should try this. And then you try it. You're like, oh yeah, that's a lot better.
Our brain's constantly moving. I told this story the other day. It's pretty funny because I'm actually not great at math, but I was in the math team growing up. And I know that's a shocker for those people who know me, but I was really good at stuff and seeing it and being like, bang, that's it. But I was always the anchor. in the competition. Mm. So we made it all the way to literally like the big state competition with our team and a bunch of smart people. And then there's me in the end, the dumb jock. And one of the things that made it a little bit easier on me is I was really good under pressure. So I knew what the clock was. And the last person basically has to handle all of the end problem after it's solved by the three people in front of you. So there's a problem that's solved. That becomes the variable that plugs into problem number two. That becomes the actual next variable that comes into problem number three. And then the solved variable becomes for problem number four that you solve, which is either right or wrong. And if any of those problems are solved incorrectly, you're obviously going to have a mixed result at the end. And then you'd have to go back and fix their work. One of the reasons why I was good is because everybody in regarding competition that was the anchor would always be watching their teammates and trying to solve problem one while they're doing it, solve problem two, and they're checking their work. And their brain is like literally exhausted by the time they get to that. And for me, I would look at the clock and I would look at our competitors to find out how much time we had, just to get a gauge. That's all I would do. I'd just be looking across and I'd look at the clock. And the minute I got it, plugged in variable and did the best I could. And it's because when you have when you take space away, you block out all that noise. Who are you on your cell phone with when you're in midair on a kiteboard? Nobody. Yeah. Who can I talk to other than some fishes and Nemo when I'm scuba diving? That's what's fascinating. I think that we as coaches constantly have our brains being cloudy because we're so trying to solve puzzles that are not ours. Solve your puzzle first, then have an opinion about other people's. But everybody wants to solve other one else's and how that affects them. Focus on what you have in front of you. It's like, let's think out of the box. You first need to know what's inside the box first.
Yeah.
Then you can start thinking outside of the box. And that's to your certification and to kind of the thing. We've done a certification on the same platform together, how much time it takes. When you're able to collapse time as a coach, you fast track. You get to take the lessons of 20, 30 years of experience and use it for yourself. That's very valuable. So I highly recommend for people to do that if that's something of interest to them. And I'm going to highly recommend for you to come to our office in Portugal so you could come to the place in Porto where we have big ass waves and you could do some kite surfing.
Yeah, shit myself.
You got to see Trevor. He's Mr. Adventure. So he likes doing all the boarding and all that stuff. So
we'll Yeah. He's got to learn to kiteboard. I was giving shit last time I saw him. Dude, you snowboard and everything. Like the board skills down. Just got to learn how to fly.
He's the snowboarder. Kane's the pickleball guy. And I like to go under the water. So we're good.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you so much for all your time and really appreciate it. I know you've got certifications and you've got stuff with Coach Catalyst. So give us the info where you can be found, what stuff you got going on if you want to be found.
Yeah. So if you are interested in speed and performance training, I did a certification that's 20 hours with myself and my mentor, Hank Krasnoff, about the art and science of speed training under Stronger Experts. You could also find one of Mike's courses there. So it's really about nutrition. And so that's there. If you want to contact me or reach out in any way, Instagram is probably the easiest platform, Coach Cav, K-A-V. And if you're a coach or a trainer that works with clients online and you want a platform that could help you scale, grow, and eliminate all of the frustrations that you deal with client behavior change and worry that you're going to be dropping the ball because you're trying to grow while you are trying to actually communicate with your clients, then you need to go to coachcatalyst.com and sign up for a free trial. I feel like you'll get a huge benefit and it will help grow your business like I know it's already done for me.
Awesome. Thank you so much for all your time. I really appreciate it. Thanks again, man.
Absolutely, man. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you. Thank you so much for listening to the podcast here. Huge thanks to Cav for coming on the podcast and sharing all of his knowledge here. Really appreciate it and was wonderful to chat with him. I've followed his stuff for a long time and finally got to meet him in person at the Real Coaches Summit in Vegas recently. And also, one of the events before that. So it's cool to see him. And if you're interested in nutrition and recovery, the Flex Diet Cert opens again June 5th, 2023 until June 12th. Go to flexdiet.com for all the information. You can sign up onto the wait list there. I'll have some exclusive bonus items only going out to the newsletter people there. And for this round, I have also decided that if you have any personal questions on anything that's in the certification, things you don't understand, or you're not sure what macronutrients or what priorities to assign to clients, you can just email me. I'll literally give you my private email. You can ask me any questions as you go through the certification. I'm not sure how much longer I'll be able to keep doing that. I really like doing it because I like the teaching aspect of it, but at some point it just becomes a bandwidth issue, but I'm going to try to do it as long as I can. So if you want a complete system on how to master nutrition and recovery, go to theflexdiet.com, FLEXDIET.com. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. Really appreciate it. I know your time is valuable and we appreciate you listening in. Again, huge thanks to Coach Cav for all of his great information here. And stay tuned. We've got a ton of guests coming up on the podcast here in the future. Brian Bornstein, Adam Ross, RD, Dr. Andy Gelpin, Dr. Scotty Butcher, Ron, and Juliet Sturette, and many more. Stay tuned in. Thank you so much. Greatly appreciate it. We will talk to you next week.
I have a good mind to go home.
You had a good mind, you wouldn't be here in the first place.